The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Tuesday evening California Time Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in tonight. Another gorgeous, very warm night in the San Francisco Bay Area. I hope wherever you are, it is equally as night. My co-host Pepper and I are here. We're expecting a great show tonight, and we look forward to your participation by phone and email. A couple of quick announcements. If you do want to give us a call, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. No call screener. Please be patient. Let the phone ring, and we'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. You can also reach us by email with your comments and questions, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. Please do remember that we are a copyrighted and trademarked show. But we do encourage all of you to share our programs. You can do this by actually emailing someone the show itself. It's around 40 to 45 megabytes. That's a little bit challenging. If you want to do that and you don't know how to do it by email, just send me a note at drspace@thespaceshow.com, and I'll be happy to share with you the free services we use to mail large email files. Or, of course, the easiest way is to send the URL for the specific show to someone. There are a couple of rules about that, although we do, as I said, encourage sharing our shows with people who are interested, should be interested, you think should be interested, and finally the group that must be interested under penalty of something or other. Here are the rules. Don't do anything commercial with our programs. And here's the biggie. Don't edit, cut, clip any segments of our programs and then put them on a website, even your own website, and certainly not on YouTube. That is a violation of our copyright, and we don't like that. And then the other one is no written transcripts, even if they're for your own personal use on your own personal website. And our copyright statement is at the bottom of every page of our spaceshow.com website, and it is also at the bottom of our One Giant Leap Foundation.org website, the parent of the Space Show, our 501c3 parent. So if you have any copyright questions, if you're just dying to cut and clip something out of a show and use it for some reason, just send me an email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Let's see if we can work it out. It's much better to ask than to just jump right in and do something and then get your hand spanked for doing it. So please check that out. Remember, also, our website is thespaceshow.com, so we do have a very detailed newsletter that gets uploaded Sunday after the Sunday program, and that has all of the information about our week's programs, our guests for the week, and it's the only place we have a future events section. Furthermore, if we have to modify our schedule at any time during the week, we do it on the website newsletter. So if you want to make sure the program you want to hear is the program you're going to hear, then check the website newsletter frequently to make sure there have been no changes. If you do tune in and you're hearing something that is foreign to you and not what was in, say, the email newsletter or what you thought we were going to be doing, before you go berserko and start trying to figure out what happened, just go to the email, go to the website newsletter. I'm sure we will have already updated it with why we've had to change our schedule and when the intended guest will be the guest on the program. You know, stuff happens with guests and with me and with equipment and technology. So from time to time, we do have to modify that schedule, and this is how you can stay up on it and know when that does happen. Everything we do is archived, and you can listen right off our website or easily download the program. It takes about 90 seconds to download a 90-minute show if you have a high-speed internet connection. And then on our blog, thespaceshow.wordpress.com, you can also listen right off of the blog, or you can easily download the shows. Plus, on the blog, you can post comments and have discussions with other listeners and often with the guests as well. So check out the blog. And then, of course, we podcast all of those shows through Gigadial, and they're there as an MP3 in the podcasting format. There is a store on our website. Look up near the top, and it'll say Space Show Gear. Check it out. Support the Space Show button is there. So this is a biggie for us right now. So remember, we are a nonprofit 501c3 with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, and it is your financial support that keeps the Space Show on the air. And right now, we are in the very early days of our crowdfunding program on Indiegogo to rebuild our website and to develop a fully searchable and archival quality database of our more than 2,500 shows, where, for the most part, you guys can't find the information you need to find, and there's no way to search that database. We're working really hard to change that. We need your help to do that. So we've just put in our newest perks for it, and boy, many of you over the years have talked about how can we sponsor the Space Show? Do you take our ads? Can we put a banner ad? Can we do this or that? Well, we've given you three sponsor options at incredible prices for this Indiegogo crowdfunding program, which, by the way, is still tax deductible. We're running our nonprofit through Indiegogo, so not only do you get the perks, you also get the tax deduction, of course, if you can use it. So the best way to find out and get the details of what we're doing, go to thespaceshow.com, and in the very upper right-hand corner, there is a box that takes you to the Support the Space Show auxiliary website that has a lot more information on it than the Indiegogo site, because Indiegogo limits what you can do on their site. On the left-hand upper side of our spaceshow.com site is an Indiegogo red and white box, and that takes you directly to our Indiegogo site, which has all of the official information, the new perks listed, how you do it, all of that is there. And then, of course, if you have any questions, you can email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Note that some of our perks are already sold out, and a couple of the others are on their way to being sold out. So check it out. Some of the really cool perks are limited in quantity. So that's for fundraising tonight, and I appreciate your support and your checking that. The other thing I do want to remember to tell you is that we are partially sponsored at this time by the Secure World Foundation, and they promote cooperative solutions for peace, space security. Excuse me. You can get a lot more information about Secure World off of their own site, www.swfound.org. They also sponsor our webinar series. And then our other sponsor, Tom Driggers, is our lifesaver. You've heard me say this many, many times on the Space Show. He has been with us for 13 of our 14 years. He is a broadcast engineer by profession, but he has saved our website. He has done more 11th-hour magical work for us with engineering equipment that you could possibly ever imagine. And were it not for Tom Driggers, probably the Space Show would have a lot of downtime and may not even be here. He is that great. And so if you need 11th-hour rescue service or just really high-quality broadcasting engineer or some website work, his information is in our sponsors page on both the One Giant Leap site and the Space Show site. So check it out. And give Tom an email or a call. I promise you, you'll be really happy, and you will love being rescued. So when I was at the New Space Conference in the exhibit hall, there was a group there that had some very interesting literature, and I talked to them several times, and it was called the Lunar Initiatives, and their website is www.lunarinitiatives, one word, .com. And I wanted to do a space show with them, so Nicole, who is with the Lunar Initiative, helped me arrange it, and we have Russell Cox with us tonight, who is the CEO and founder of the Lunar Initiative. Russell has an extensive background in an entrepreneurial coaching, training, and workshop way, as well as with several startup projects, from his first business plan for a NASA shuttle Getaway Special Support Company, to later founding a Silicon Valley computer startup, Oak Multi Computer. His primary project currently is the Lunar Initiative, where he is the visionary and the thought leader behind three main initiatives: the Lunar Workshops, Lunar Artwork, and Lunar Challenges. Mr. Cox got two Bachelor of Science degrees from the University of Texas at Austin, both in physics and in math, and he has many years of exposure to lunar and planetary science and has presented to both national and international audiences on the future of space exploration. And Russell, you don't know it, but I grew up in Oklahoma, so when I say hook 'em horns, you're in for a show tonight, let me tell you.
All right.
Are you ready?
I'm absolutely ready.
So welcome, and give us kind of the overview or the 101. I mean, I understand, and I've got your brochures, but the listeners don't have your brochures. You've got three components to the lunar initiatives that go on over a certain specified period of time. How did you come up with this, and give us the overview?
This all began back in 2009, when the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter and the LCROSS mission are the two big ones that made it to the moon. So a lot of the lunar background that most people really isn't on the tip of their tongue. With the Bush administration, it said we're going back to the moon, and they were going to do a Apollo program on steroids. And in preparation for that, they sent the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, and it's a very clever program called the LCROSS, which crashed into the moon and dug up the soil there and told us what was going on. So before those two missions actually made it to the moon, everybody thought, including President Obama, said the moon is very boring. We've been there. We've done that. Why would we spend money to go back to the moon? That was a bit of a political ploy to try and kill the Bush program that was going out of, they'd spent $9 billion and they barely got started. So you had to kill that program for money reasons. But fortunately, before they did that, they had already sent the reconnaissance orbiter. And when Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter got there, they found out that nothing could be farther from the truth. Nobody had ever observed the lunar poles carefully. A few missions had looked at it a little bit, but nobody had done really detailed analysis. And when they did, when LRO did, they found out that the lunar poles are very cold, about 40 degrees above absolute zero. In fact, there are places that are only 20 degrees above absolute zero on the moon, which is the coldest place in the solar system. They found that there were many other things. In particular, it looks like there's a lot of water ice, CO2 ice, very interesting science and potentially entrepreneurship, because if there's as much ice there as they think, then you can go mine that and you can use that water to make rocket fuel or water or oxygen for any number of uses. And so suddenly it went from a really boring place to a really exciting place, just both from the scientific point of view. If you want to study the moon, it's totally different than anybody thought it was. If you want to study, like, the icy moons of Jupiter, well, the ice on the moon is at the same temperature as on Jupiter, so you could go to the moon and build equipment, test your science there. So the world really changed in 2009 for planetary science and lunar science in particular. So in order for me to, my first thought was, well, is this really true? I'd been in and out of planetary science for 20, 30 years because I grew up in Houston, and so going to the moon was in my blood. And so I said, is my intuition of how important these discoveries are true? So I started going to lunar workshops again and attending planetary science conferences and asking the professionals, this is what I think just happened, and this is really what happened. And the answer was absolutely. The world changed. And so one of the ways that you can learn quickly, one of the ways that you can get people to talk to you is by running a workshop. So since I was not currently plugged in to the lunar planetary community, I needed to become plugged in because this was something I was working on. And at the time, I was the CEO of a cryogenic engineering company, and we were working on the James Webb Space Telescope. So, and that operates at 40 Kelvin. So there was a tie-in between the lunar science and the engineering company I had at the time. Now the engineering company has gone away, and it's all about the events and the workshops. So over the past 6 years, we started off with a lunar superconductor applications workshop to look at the cryogenic concept. Over time, it's grown into the much broader initiatives because there's a lot to do, and there's a lot of different ways to approach this. And so we'll talk about those a little bit more, but that was how it all got started. I saw it was one of those rare moments where the very first image that came down on one of the LR instruments called Diviner, its very first image showed that the poles were at 40 Kelvin. And that one image told anybody who'd been wondering about this that everything had changed. So that's how we got started.
Why did it change because of the temperature?
Because in order for water ice to be stable on the moon, you have to be colder than about 100 degrees Kelvin or 100 degrees above absolute zero. So people had seen water ice on places like Mercury. Mercury poles are also very cold. And they had seen the indications of water ice on the moon. But they'd done their analysis and said, well, maybe if we're lucky, some of the craters at the top and the bottom of the moon, the North and South Pole, because the moon rotates in the plane of the ecliptic, the poles never see the sun. And there are what are called permanently shadowed craters that never see the sun. They haven't seen the sun for a billion years. So the original analysis would be lucky if there'd be a couple of them that were down around 100 degrees Kelvin. And so maybe there might be a little bit of water, or what we call volatile ices, things that otherwise would melt and go away. And when it was proven that it was that cold, you basically knew for a fact that there had to be some water there. And then there were a couple of other missions, one called M-Cube on the Chandrian orbiter. So an Indian orbiter was up just before LRO, and they orbited the moon, and they had a U.S. instrument on there called M-Cube, the Moon Mineralogy Mapper, and it began to detect that there was water on the surface of the moon. It began to detect that there's like, you know, one water molecule per dust grain, but it was very noticeable. And that was a lot more than anybody thought would be there. And then when they proved that the poles were very cold, in fact, the coldest places in the solar system, then that meant that there's a lot of this very cold chemistry and physics going on that no one knew was there. And so nobody had studied it yet. Nobody had thought carefully about what it means. And now, even 6 years later, it's still not at all obvious what exactly is going on. It's a very exciting place for the physicists. I love it when we don't know what's going on. And so it's very, very interesting and intriguing, the kinds of things that can happen down at those temperatures. And they're very important for technology reasons. One of my catchphrases is, if the room is at 40 Kelvin, you have room temperature superconduction. So we'll see how that plays out. But you can do interesting technology at very cold temperatures. You can do interesting science and physics at very cold temperatures. And that science also has implications to, like, the icy moons of Jupiter, Titan, Saturn. There's very interesting chemistry and physics going on there that no human has thought carefully about. And there may even be life in some of those locations. And so it's become a really critical location. And one of the key things that was a key indicator that was going to be a lot more interesting than anybody thought was that very cold temperature.
So, have you been running? Do you run workshops? Is that what your object is to teach about the moon?
Yes, so we began by running, as I said, the initial workshop, which we affectionately call LSA, so that's Lunar Surface Application, and brought in the scientists and said, "So tell me what changed, and tell me about the kinds of engineering we're going to need to do to go and look at these very cold places." So we began with the surface applications workshop. Which now has morphed into the world premier workshop on landers and rovers. We ran the last one last April, and we had six different lunar lander programs. Several of the Google Lunar X Prizes were there, The NASA program was there. So it turns out there's a lot of people going back to the moon, and they come to that workshop. We've now branched out into three workshops. So the other two are, one is lunar cubes. So we're talking about CubeSats. So there's a whole miniaturization movement that's been going on for a long time. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with Moore's Law, where computers get more powerful and smaller every year. Well, that really hasn't happened in space, because space is such a conservative place. They don't typically use the latest and the greatest technology. They actually use what they know works. So one of the objectives is to take these miniature things like your iPhone, is a far more powerful computer than a typical satellite, even a big one. And so we're trying to push that into orbit. And for the last 10 years, it's been a CubeSat program. So CubeSat's a small 10 centimeters, 8 inches on a side, a small cube. What most people fly is a CubeSat with three cubes in it, and that looks kind of like a loaf of bread, basically. And it turns out you can get real science done with those kinds of small satellites. The challenge right now, most people build those and fly them in low Earth orbit. Lots of people have seen the images of them being launched off the International Space Station now. So a lot of people are launching CubeSats off of ISS. We want to do them in deep space. And so in deep space, you have more challenges. The temperatures are more challenging. You have higher radiation levels, longer missions typically often. So lunar cubes is like, how do we take the very successful CubeSat program and extend it out into deep space? Starting at the moon, but it's taken off to go to Mars or Venus or anywhere in the solar system, actually. It'd be very useful, little or small size. And then we have a third workshop called Scientific Opportunities in Cislunar Space. So cislunar means in and around the moon. And so it turns out that there's been an armada. We talked a little bit about LRO, Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, but there were about 11 different missions, all went to the moon right around 2009. So between 2009 and about 2011, there were 10, 11 different spacecraft made it to the moon and observed lots of interesting things. It turns out the plasmas and the atmosphere around the moon is really interesting. So that even if you don't go down to the surface, the physics is different than what people thought it would be. One of my phrases is, everything is simple until you measure it. And we now have just measured a whole bunch of stuff at the moon and found out it's far more complex, far more interesting, far richer place to do science. And that science then applies throughout the solar system. And in fact, now it goes even beyond that, because now with the Kepler mission, we know Kepler has observed thousands of planets outside and around other stars beyond our own. And so now we know there are more planets than stars. So our solar system is relevant to studying the entire universe, and in particular also studying the question, is there life in the universe? Because there's almost certainly life in our solar system, and we'll get into that a little more later as well. So that's become the three workshop series that we do, and then this year we're adding challenges and competitions and a hackathon. We'll talk about those a little more. Those are the other two initiatives, Lunar Artwork and Lunar Challenges. So the lunar workshops are technical. They're intended for people actually building CubeSats and rovers and landers. The challenges and competition are going to be have the kind of components that anybody can play, all the way from an amateur a high school student, all the way up to professionals will find things of interest to do in our challenges and competition.
So do people attend all of these workshops if they have the time?
Some people do. Like I said, the serious people do. But typically, now that we're getting closer, there's the lander and rover groups and the surface application. That tends to be a slightly different group. You tend to have more national programs, although you have, again, the Google Lunar X Prize. So people aren't aware that Google put up a $30 million prize and said the first person to land on the moon, row 500 meters and send back a video, we'll get $30 million. And so 26 or 7 teams set up to go try and win that prize 5 or 6 years ago now. Now we're down to about 20 teams left, 18 to 20 teams. And there are 5 or 6 of them are very credible. 5 or 6 of them are almost certainly going to fly, at least once. And then there's two or three that are trying hard to make a company or a business out of it. So Moon Express, Astrobotic, want to become flying, you know, every couple of years for the rest of their life. So you have a couple of companies that are trying to be startups and be flying to the moon on a regular basis. You have several that want to fly at least once or twice to prove that they've got good stuff. So, like, Part-Time Scientists is a really good group out of Germany. They've got a really great rover, and they'll either hitch a ride on somebody else's lander or fly it themselves at some point. So that group tends to be, you know, larger companies and things. And then CubeSats tend to be, any graduate student should be working on a CubeSat. That's one of my, another one of my things. Anybody who's serious about being, becoming a top planetary scientist had better be working on their CubeSat. Because, you know, if you want to be a leader in the field, building and flying your own experiments is the way to go. And it becomes available. You know, a regular CubeSat for low Earth orbit is like $100,000, $500,000, to do some science. But that, and that's really inexpensive. People put out kind of toy ones for $10,000, if the ride's free. But in terms of science, $100,000 is, you know, again, a grad student can easily get a grant that size. Going to the moon, you see, it'll be like $1 million to $5 million. But even that's really cheap compared to, you know, this lunar reconnaissance orbiter was $800 million. So NASA's idea of cheap is different than mine. But, you know, $2 million is very achievable to a small university, you know, a space program in an Eastern European country could easily put together that kind of money and build a team to go get one of these things built and flown. So it's still a little harder and a little more money than just regular CubeSats. But it is the kind of thing that a graduate student team can build and fly in 3 or 4 years. And then technical opportunities is pure science. And it's also different. All of our workshops are also different in the sense that they're very interactive. We get people in there, you watch 4 or 5 lectures, and then we do a 1-hour design challenge where we get the top scientists and anyone who wants to attend. They are open to everybody. But we have a lot of people from JPL and Goddard, and then other, you know, the Google XPRIZE teams. Astrobotic's been there every year. Moon Express is often there. So it's really top-tier people. So anybody who wants to come can sit next to somebody from JPL or Astrobotic and learn how we're building this and creating these new opportunities that ultimately will explode. Another phrase I use is the lunar renaissance. The opportunities for people have become really amazing. What's going to happen in the next 10 to 20 years is it's a science fiction explosion people thought was going to happen a few years ago is about to happen now. And we're trying to do everything we can to make that happen faster and include more people. So it's another feature where, especially when we get into the challenges and competitions, those will all be global. So everything we do is intended to be international from the start, intended to be global, intended to include as many different kinds of people as we can.
What do they cost to go to?
So typically it's a 4-day workshop, and so I think the current price is like $4.99. But we feed you all day, so you get breakfast, lunch, and dinner as well.
Really? All meals are included?
Yeah, so the meals are included, and then we have an evening program. So it's a full-featured workshop. And for a 5-day or 4-day workshop, that's a pretty typical price for a real science workshop. So it's about $500. You can get it on the internet, but the internet is, I think, $50 a day if you want to watch the program live. And then after a certain amount of time, we also get it up on the website, and you can go back and look at the previous presentation and engage that way. We have Facebook pages for all the different sites. We have a Lunar Initiative Facebook page, Hack the Moon Facebook page for the hackathon, Lunar Workshops Facebook page, and we're growing our Twitter community. So we're growing our social media engagement. We want to also, again, with bringing in the art competition and the hackathon. So let me put those two bullet points on there. This time around, we're adding to this technical workshop, we're adding a weekend hackathon. So NASA does what they call NASA SpaceX Challenge. And in April, they do a two-day hackathon, and I think they had 150 different locations all around the world last April. And we sponsored two of those locations, one in Sacramento and one in Mojave. So starting this, the next event is Lunar Cubes in October in San Jose, California. So Lunar Cubes is the next event coming up. And the workshop is October 6th through 9th. And then the hackathon is the 10th and the 11th of October. And that's International Space Week, by the way. So our contribution to that is going to be, we're going to be running the hackathon and also having an art competition. So in September, we're going to run a flash art competition, so graphic art and short stories. And so we'll run something very quick, hand out those prizes. And with the hackathon, you can come and we'll allow other people to set up other cities. So we'll probably have, I know we're going to have at least San Jose and Sacramento this year, and I have some interest from some other cities. But the thing that will be different and interesting about our hackathon is that it's going to be focused on space. So we're working with the NASA Moon Mapping Project to give people access to the actual lunar map. And so you can go and analyze a site on the moon just the way the scientists do. And we'll give you enough instruction that you can get started on that. And you can write a cell phone app to download real science data on your phone if you like. So we're going to create a series of games and challenges for the weekend that are all based on this. NASA makes all of their science data public. So you can go to what's called the Planetary Data System, PDS, and you can essentially download the raw images from any mission NASA's had in the last 10 years. Now, the raw data is a little hard to deal with, so we're working with NASA to create, certainly for the moon, an interface that's a lot easier to deal with, and then we'll put together some instruction on, well, this is how you would use it. This is how you take down a picture that shows you the surface. Here's the picture that has the topographical altitude data. Here's where you would download the temperature data. And so now you can put together a picture that shows you, you know, here's the hills in the crater, here's what it looks like, and then here's the temperature on a particular day. And those are the kinds of composite images that real lunar scientists use to design missions. And so what we're going to do is try and make that accessible to people so you can go and analyze a site, and we'll give you enough introduction into the system and what it would look like to do something that begins to look like lunar geology as an amateur. You know, what I'm hoping is it'll create, like, the amateur astronomy community is very broad, and they go all the way from, you know, young kids looking at the stars saying this is cool, all the way up to the professional amateurs who do work that's as good as almost any scientist. We want to really create that sort of community for planetary science. And so through the hackathon and through the art competition, we're going to give ways for people to engage with the lunar science, with the missions that are coming up, with the data that's already available, and learn, like I said, why is it interesting that there are craters on the moon that are 40 degrees above absolute zero? So it'll be a very hands-on, very engaging environment. And it will be, again, it will be global. We'll run it twice a year. We're going to support the NASA Space App in April. We'll run our Hack the Moon in every October. We did two locations last April. We'll probably do between 3 and 5 this October. And next year, hopefully, when we get back to Space App, we'll sponsor, say, 10, and begin growing and creating this venue for people to engage and participate in the lunar renaissance, participate in this new explosion in opportunity that is just beginning to happen. And what I've found in the last 5 years running these workshops is this time it's real. This time we're really going back. This time individuals really can go back. You look at what SpaceX is doing. All the commercial programs are dramatically outperforming the national program. And so in terms of entrepreneurship, in terms of public involvement, in terms of international communities and teams, the human race is going back to the moon. And it's a really exciting time to be part of it.
Let me give you a question from Ken. in Wichita, Kansas, and he said, for those of us who don't really know what a hackathon is, please tell us.
Great, thanks. Excellent question. So in the last several decades, one of the things that computer software people had done that is fun is they would get together and over the course of a weekend try and solve a problem. And so many people turned this into kind of a game. They rent a room and they invite 100 people to come in and say, start typing, and they hand out a prize on Sunday. So we're going to do some of that. We're talking to IBM and Google and Amazon. And so what happens is when you're there that weekend, they'll give you free access to some of their tools. And then we have the NASA Lunar Mapping Program, and you'll get access to the lunar mapping data system. And we'll have some training videos on how you can start plugging those things together, how can you use the Amazon tools that people use to build websites to access lunar data. So typically, a hackathon usually is a software thing. And then for people who like to build stuff, they call them maker fairs. But it's part of what they call the DIY, the do-it-yourself group. And so if you go out and look for maker fairs or hackathons or fabrication labs, there's different kinds of maker labs out there where you can go, and they'll give you access to things like 3D printers or different kinds of fabrication hardware and software. So there's a huge movement out there called do-it-yourself. And that's kind of the attitude that goes into the CubeSat world. That's the attitude we want to bring into this, the catchphrase for Pack the Moon is, it's your moon, what are you waiting for? And really small groups of enthusiastic people are going to be able to get a lot of work done. And so what we're doing is creating an environment where you can come together and be in a room with, say, 50 other people. Some of them will be very knowledgeable. Some of them will be brand new, and so you can learn very quickly. And so you can if you're less knowledgeable, you join a team with other people who are knowledgeable, or if you've got a pet project of your own. For example, I have a couple of craters on the moon that I'd love to go and build some geologic maps around. And so I might come in and say, okay, I want to study this crater. So there's like one is a really Tycho crater. Most people know where Tycho crater is. It's down in the lower right-hand corner. It's this big, beautiful rays. So it would be fun to say, okay, I raise my hand. I want to explore Tycho crater this weekend. Who wants to join me? And then five or six of us sit around the table and say, okay, let's go figure out how to download the images. Let's go look at some of this other kinds of information that you can find. And typically, like I said, you can get the 3D map, so you can print out in a 3D printer the Tycho crater. We probably won't have a 3D printer at the location, but we'll have access to some, and certainly that's going to be one of the first things we're going to do is give everybody instructions on how to print out on a 3D printer your favorite crater, and then you go down to your hacker dojo or your other hacker facility that lets you rent or use 3D printers and see what you can do. So there's a lot of stuff. Like I said, your iPhone is a more powerful computer than most planetary scientists have ever been able to play with. And because of that, they actually, they know a lot about planetary science, but they don't actually know very much about the kinds of kits that people build quadcopters out of. It's another, the maker community invented the quadcopter. They just went out and built them themselves. So we want to bring that energy of the makers and the hackers into space. And those guys know a lot of stuff that real planetary scientists know. And real planetary scientists know a lot of things that these guys would find interesting and valuable to learn. So we're all of our, from the technical workshops to the hackathon, all of our events are designed to be this crossroads for any kind of skill level, any kind of interest level. You bring your excitement and you'll meet people who know things you'd like to learn and would like to learn what you already know. So that's the essence of the hackathon. And I really can't wait until, like the Space Apps Challenge, we are running, 50 of them all over the same weekend all around the world. I already have someone from Bulgaria wants to run one, and there's a woman in New York who wants to run one. So it's going to be a lot of fun when we're setting up these events that over 40 hours you have, you know, 1,000 people.
Now, where are the hackathons? Where are the hackathons listed on your website?
So they are. If you go to Lunar Cubes, because right now they're being added to Lunar Cubes, so go to lunarcubes.com. There's a link on there for the hackathon weekend, and then the actual registration is done through Eventbrite. So if you go to Eventbrite and look up Hack the Moon, you should find our registration pages. And they're all on the Cubes. We'll be posting more information as we go. And then there's the Facebook page, Hack the Moon, on Facebook. We'll also be posting the events on that site. So you can go find the events on the Facebook page. And we'll be posting notices about that on Facebook and Twitter. So I believe we have Hack the Moon on Twitter as well.
You've got another question from Ralph in Omaha. And he says, I understand your focus is on the moon. Do you see the moon as a stepping stone with Mars as the real destination, or are you looking at the moon as a final destination, an ending destination, and to stay there?
Great, thanks. So, yeah, the moon is absolutely a stepping stone to the rest of the solar system, not just Mars. The way I describe the moon is the moon is San Francisco in 1849. All the 49ers went to San Francisco, not because they wanted to go to San Francisco. They wanted to go out into the mountains and find the gold. So during the gold rush, they wanted to go to the Yukon. They wanted to go to the Sierra, but you always started in San Francisco. That's where you bought your shovels and your mules and took your classes. And then from my point of view as an entrepreneur, it's in that staging area where the economy gets built. That's where the banks went. That's where the universities went. That's where all the infrastructure, the opera house, gets built. So the moon is going to be the first stopping point. Whether you're talking about orbiting the moon to get slingshot out into the rest of the solar system, or you're going to do some manufacturing on the moon, you're going to go build your, you know, mine the water and create rocket fuel and use that rocket fuel to get you to Mars. One way or the other, NASA's now finally talking about the moon as the proving ground. It's a place where we're going to learn to be a spacefaring species. It's where we're going to learn how to really do this right. And from there, you go to Mars. The other really exciting places, which ironically are all tied together with this cryogenic, very cold temperature piece, is Mars is interesting. Since I'm not a government official, I can say I believe there's life on Mars. I think there's lots of water glaciers on Mars. And underneath those water ice glaciers are water ice lakes. And those water lakes on Mars probably look exactly like the water lakes under glaciers on Earth. And there's all kinds of life. You're talking bacteria and things, maybe some small worms or something. But from a biological point of view, and the point of view is there life at all? What we now know for a fact is what I call habitable terrain. There are habitable terrains on Mars. There are places where, if that was on Earth, it would be filled with life. There are habitable terrains on the icy moons of Jupiter and Saturn. So Enceladus and Europa are the two things people are looking at. There's underneath that ice surface are water oceans, liquid water oceans. And those liquid water oceans probably look almost exactly like the water oceans around Antarctica and under the ice on the Earth. And again, what we know is there are almost certainly habitable terrains. There's terrains where you've got liquid water, you've got rocks and minerals, you've got the gravitational tug is heating things up and pumping the energy into the system. So these are these geysers in Europa. So you know there's energy going on out there. And so, again, if those oceans were on the Earth, they would be filled with life. What we've learned, it's really amazing. Not only has the moon changed in the last 10 years, but almost everything out there has changed. We now know for a fact there are more planets than stars in the universe. We didn't know that 10 years ago. 10 years ago, we thought maybe there was some planets. But if you'd ask a knowledgeable planetary scientist, they said, yeah, you know, we'll find some planets out around other stars, but don't look like ours. Jupiter's where Jupiter is for a very good reason. And it turns out nothing can be farther from the truth. All those planetary systems look nothing like ours. But they have habitable terrains in them, almost certainly. They have, either on the surface or under the surface in underground rivers and lakes, in the cloud. So we now know that not only are there habitable terrains in our solar system, but there are habitable terrains around, throughout the universe. And even on Earth, we've discovered, again, just the last 10 years or so, just how robust life is. There's life in nuclear power plants. There's bacteria that grow in nuclear waste sites. No one ever thought that was possible. There's life at the bottom of the ocean, because everybody thought you had to have some sort of photosynthesis to have life. Well, in the Pacific Northwest, there's these volcanoes right off the coast here, and they're teeming with life. And none of that life has anything to do with sunlight. It's all about the energy coming out of the volcanoes. Well, there's almost certainly, or there certainly have been, those kinds of volcanoes in under the ice on these icy moons. The most exciting one, the most interesting one, is the moon of Titan. It has an icy ocean underneath its surface like the other two moons. But it has lakes of liquid ethane and methane on the surface. So these lakes are at 90 degrees above absolute zero, and they're all hydrocarbons. There's at least one scientist who thinks he's detected life on the surface of Titan, that in these ethane lakes, there's something that behaves like life. Certainly what I know is no human has ever studied, you know, what does organic chemistry at 90 degrees Kelvin over a billion years look like? So, and then when we got to Pluto, guess what? Everybody assumed everything is simple until you measure it. Everybody thought Pluto would be this nice, smooth ball, you know, a nice little ice ball out there. It'll have some, you know, maybe some ridges or something, but that's not what we found at all. It's got mountains. There's something at 40 degrees above absolute zero can build mountains on Pluto. Most people have said that there's not enough energy to do anything like that. So what we knew is that we continue to be startled and stunned by every new measurement, every new mission. The moon is, most people are going to use the moon as a stepping stone to someplace else. I personally happen to like the moon, but I'm aware that most other people are going there for the reason. But while they're going, I'll get to do some science there too. The moon is very interesting in its own right. Both the geology and now the whole cryogenic volatiles. Because again, how do these things evolve? It's people believe that these cryogenic ices are actually the beginning of life in the universe. We see them on comets. People talk about them on comets. We now know that pretty much anything that happens on a comet can also happen in a crater on the moon. And a crater on the moon is a lot easier to get to than going back to another comet. You can only go to comets every 10, 20, 30 years. You can go to the moon any day of the week.
Russell, hold it there. We're at our point where we need to take our break, okay?
Thanks.
And listeners, we're coming back in about 3 minutes, so don't go anywhere. And for those of you who would like to give us a call, and remember, we do answer the phone during the break, the toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. Back in 3 minutes.
With the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to part two of our Tuesday Space Show program. Our guest is Russell Cox, the CEO and founder of the Lunar Initiatives, and you can somewhat follow along with us at www.lunarinitiatives, all one word, .com. And our phone number, for those of you who would like to give us a call, 1-866-687-7223. Email, which you've been using, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And you have a note that came in at the end of the last segment from Ben in Boston. And he says, do you have a focus at all on developing and building lunar habitats and establishing a lunar settlement? Settlement is a big part of some segments of the space industry, such as the new space segment.
Yeah, thank you for that. And absolutely, that's where we're going. And kind of the way I see it is the settlements will happen when we need humans on the moon. So it's absolutely going to happen. Whether it's 10 years, 20 years, or 30 years, that's a little harder to say. Sooner is better as far as I'm concerned. And so the way I approach that problem is before we can put up a habitat, there's an enormous amount of science and engineering that needs to be done. And so with our challenges and with our workshop, our focus is what can you build right now? What mission could we build and fly in the next 2 to 3 years that would push back the envelope, that would push back our need to prove new technologies, our need to discover exactly how the science works so that we can build things safely and efficiently. So habitats on the moon and eventually Mars and the entire solar system is indeed, you know, by the end of the century, that's exactly where we're going to be. We're going to be everywhere. Right now, my focus is what can we do today? We were talking during a break a little bit about, gee, it would be nice if the governments would come along. And my thing is I'm done waiting. We've been waiting 40, 50 years. And the governments are going to have a role, but they're going really slowly. You know, whether it's the U.S. government, the Russian government, ESA, the European government, all of these government programs, by their nature, have to go really, really slowly. So I'm an entrepreneur. I'm not going to wait anymore. And the cost of these things and the complexity of these things has gotten down to the point to where small teams of dedicated people with, you know, a few tens of millions of dollars, so it's not free, but it's not billions. It doesn't have to be billions anymore. It can easily be, you know, a few million dollars for a CubeSat, a few tens of millions of dollars for a much more competent orbital observatory or something. These are all things that people can raise money for. The astronomy community raises $1 billion for a new telescope every year or two. So we could do the same. My focus is on that. But that's going to be one of the games. In fact, that was with the Hack the Moon and the challenges. One of the ways you had to give people an idea of space problems, one of the kind of science fiction ideas that is really not science fiction anymore, yet is, well, what would happen if we discovered there really was a killer asteroid out there and it was headed towards the Earth, and we either had to divert it away from the Earth or we need to build a lifeboat on the moon. And so how could we get a habitable community of, say, 10,000 people on the moon in 5 or 10 years? If the world was going to end in 10 years, could we build a lifeboat for humanity on the moon? And so that will give us a context. And so we'll look at, well, what would the technology need to be created? What science do you need to do? Almost certainly human habitats on the moon are going to be underground. And so a variety of cave systems that could be very good for having habitats in. And so one of the first things you would do is go up there with some robots and go explore those caves and see how they work and are they really as good as they think they might be. So And another aspect of this is you know, why wait? We don't need to wait. It's a little more challenging than the typical person can do, but it's not more challenging than like say, a small university or a team of entrepreneurs. There's at least two projects have kickstarted over $1 million for space projects. So you can raise quite a lot of money if you've got the vision, if you've got a credible team. You can kickstart a few hundred thousand dollars. You can kickstart $1 million and get started. One of the ways I talk about this is the road to the moon is open. I call it the Yukon Trail to Mars. Right now, we mentioned that people are launching CubeSats off of the space station. Well, I call that the supply chain. We're flying the space station every couple of months to resupply a station. That's a continuous process. The price is only going to go down. The amount of mass available for things like CubeSats being launched off of stations is only going to go up. So that's a routine process. You know exactly how much it's going to cost. You know when you can fly. You just pull out your credit card and say, you know, I'd like to fly 2 years from now. Thank you very much. What do I do next? The next layer up, so that's low Earth orbit. Very hard to get from low Earth orbit to the moon, so that's not quite what we want. But there's a company called Space Systems Loral, and they build really big telecommunication satellites, and they launch 5 to 6 of these a year. And on every one, they now have an empty battery bay. Batteries have gotten more efficient. They don't need this extra battery bay. So they want to put, it's about the size of a suitcase, 150 kilograms, which is about 300 pounds. That's quite substantial. So you can build your own little sub-spacecraft. You put it in there. They get into geosynchronous orbit, which is where all the communication satellites are. It's 90% of the way to the moon. And then they'll kick you out from there, and then you go the rest of the way. And that, too, is the supply chain. It's just now getting started, but they basically fly 6 times a year. Once we get the designs for these carriers, once we get, you know, the paperwork done for the first time, you'll be able to, again, take your credit card out and say, you know, I want to fly 3 years from now, in the summer. And you'll have 2 or 3 choices, and you can book your flight. And that's, nothing new has to happen for that to become reality. That is reality. We're trying to, and through my workshop, the competition, we're trying to get people to actually start working on those carriers. Because 150 kilograms in geosynchronous orbit, that's a lunar mission. You know, you make half of that in your propulsion system, and you can get something like 8 CubeSats in lunar orbit. That's a very robust science mission. 8 CubeSats in lunar orbit, take you three, four years to build all that, get it flown, the supply chain's there. It's not going anywhere. So the opportunities now exist. And my goal and objective, the lunar initiative, is to create some initiatives, to get some momentum going, to get people out there thinking about, well, what can I build today? And, you know, how could I use my iPhone as a CubeSat? And how would I download the data? And how would I control a small spacecraft with something like an iPhone or an Android? People are playing those games. You'll be able to play those games at our hackathon event. And either literally or just online, we'll put out some kits and you can work with your team locally. If you don't happen to live in one of the locations of one of our hackathons, there'll be interactive ways for you to play. You can watch the presentations or work with some of the software. So, absolutely, there are going to be humans in space.
Okay.
That ultimately is the goal.
Got another question from you. Bob is in Chicago. And Bob says, I follow the entrepreneurial community and the new space community pretty closely, and I think you're pushing their technology readiness level. I don't disagree with you that the private sector and the entrepreneur will eventually get to the moon, but I don't think it's today or in a year or two or maybe even 5 to 7 years. Do you think you might be just a little pushy and trying to advance their TRLs before they're ready?
Thank you for that. And there's kind of two answers. One, it is absolutely my goal to be pushy. I want this to happen sooner rather than later. But actually, NASA has a program kind of like the Google Lunar X Prize. They now have a CubeQuest program. And so with the Space Launch System, the SLS, their big new rocket, which is supposed to fly in 2018, one of the things they're going to do on its first test flight which goes by the moon, they're going to launch 11 CubeSats. So NASA has 11 slots for lunar cubes, and our science director won one of the first. They selected about four or five of them, of the 11, and our science director, Pamela Clark, won the proposal for one of those CubeSats. So she's got her $5 million budget, and we'll see if we can find some more money, but for she's got $5 million from NASA, a launch opportunity in 2018, and she's going to be building a 6U CubeSat with propulsion and navigation and a really good spectrometer. And, yeah, the first flights are all about pushing the technology. If you remember the original Ranger program, the first, like, five failed completely. You know, they blew up on the launch pad, one of them missed the moon entirely, another one got there, but the instruments didn't turn on. It wasn't until they got up to Ranger 9 that everything worked properly. So if you're trying to go quickly, if you're trying to really push the envelope, you want to be able to sustain a high failure rate, and that's what the CubeSats have done. CubeSats in low Earth orbit have a failure rate of 50%. That's a little higher than I'd like to see it, but if you're really going to try and change the world quickly, that's what it looks like. You're not waiting until you're doing these NASA Class A missions where, you know, a 90-day rover actually is a 5-year rover. We really want things to be built to purpose, and that's how you get the cost down. That's how you get the price down. And, yeah, there's going to be a lot of failures along the way, which is why the humans go later. But you know, that's the whole lean startup model. That's the whole modern entrepreneurship model, is you learn by doing, you learn by flying, you learn by making mistakes. And so we're trying to create a psychological place where that's safe for people. And then as these missions become available, NASA has, of those 11 slots they're going to pick, that some of them, they have a challenge where you can compete and they're going to fly three of them. And then, again, that's in 2018. So these are, again, non-governmental programs. Some of them are JPL satellites, but all the challenge ones are just like Google XPRIZE teams. Teams of individuals getting together trying to make it happen. And, you know, we'll see how far they get. And every time you try something, you learn something. And that's another thing. I'll kind of bring that up. Another really important aspect of the Lunar Initiative and our challenges and workshops is another thing that needs to happen is, you know, when I first started talking to people 5-6 years ago, there are probably, you know, 1,000 planetary scientists who, you know, professional planetary scientists on planet Earth. You know, you go to one of these conferences and they're all there. Half of them are grad students, and so they're not really quite professionals yet. But there's really a tiny group of people who know how to do this. And we're going to need a lot more than that. We're going to need, you know, I think Apollo had 400,000 people in it. We're going to need something like hundreds of thousands of people all over planet Earth learning how to build these kinds of systems if we're really, as humanity, going to be going back to the moon and on to Mars and Europa. So that's another key objective of this, is from the enthusiast who just want to buy a T-shirt to the, you know, grad student who wants to learn how to build a CubeSat, to the professional who has a real science objective and they want to get this done. We're creating that environment, and we're creating a place for people to come and develop an awareness of these technologies and to push these technologies forward. And, yeah, and that's how close to the bleeding edge of technology you want to get is the user's choice. So there'll be plenty of people out there blowing stuff up. Not literally, because you don't want to blow up a CubeSat in space. That's
right.
Bad. Space junk is bad. Yes.
I was going to read you another email that came in. Do you want to take it, or
please,
do you have something more?
Yes.
Okay, but first, listeners, it is Tuesday evening, and as I always say, most of you are not at work, so pick up the phone. Your phone calls are a lot more fun. 1-866-687-7223. So Jane is in Denver, and what Jane says is many of us who support returning to the moon for all of what you said, although we think human settlement would be a lot faster happening than what you seem to think, But key to this is to have a cislunar transportation system that is a routine and low-cost Earth-Moon transportation system, either for the robots as well as for humans. Are you at all focused on helping to develop cislunar transportation, or do you just start at the moon?
Thank you for that. I don't know who paid you to ask that question, but one of the challenges that we're going to be announcing in October is exactly that. It is the Alden Bell Bruno Cislunar Navigation Challenge. So it turns out there's new mathematics. They've discovered another thing that this is a little older. These initial discoveries were made in the 80s, but even so, very few people are actually utilizing them. But Ed Bell Bruno discovered that if you're willing to be a little patient, you take 6 to 9 months to get to the moon instead of 3 days, you can double your payload to the moon. But Aldrin discovered a class of orbits called the Aldrin Cyclers, which are kind of like a ferry. They just continuously go back and forth between the Earth and the moon, or you can also do it between the Earth and Mars. So Buzz, in fact, actually asked us at one of our workshops, could we do some work on this? Try and figure out, get some people to do some science and then software and testing. And so we're going to create a challenge. Our first big money challenge, which will be announced in October, is the Aldrin Bell Bruno Cislunar Navigation Challenge. And it will have those three components. It will be, there'll be prizes for working on the Aldrin Cyclers, which is, again, a continuous ferry between essentially geosynchronous orbit and the moon. There will be prizes for developing software and mathematics for these high-payload, low-energy transfers. And there will be prizes for mission management. If you imagine, as I do, you're probably going to end up with another carrier out there. It's called an ESPA ring. So an ESPA ring is an adapter between the second and third stage of a rocket. And those have a lot of extra space on them. So people are now using those adapter rings as carriers for CubeSats. And so one of the models is an ESPA ring can get something like 150 CubeSats to Lunar L1. And there are a lot of really interesting projects you would do if you had 100 CubeSats at Lunar L1. And in fact, one of the keynote speakers at Lunar Cubes this October in San Jose is going to be presenting their carrier that will go from geosynchronous to Lunar L1, and they're interested in asteroids, so they're going to want to put asteroid observatories at L1. And then also there's a class of very small asteroids that actually come and hang around the Earth for several months at a time. I think it's about 10 times a year, a little 1-meter asteroid gets wanders around the Earth and the Moon. And if it stays here for that long, then it's actually that close, something like a CubeSat can almost certainly chase it down. And so one of the programs I'm promoting through the workshops and encouraging speakers and presenters to work on, and at some point we'll have challenges as well to support this work, is indeed those carriers that can get you from geosynchronous to L1, L1 to orbit or the surface. So, yeah, building out that infrastructure, and I said the way I think about it is the road to the moon is open all the way out to geosynchronous. And hypothetically, with a little bit more technology development, all the way out to Lunar L1, we want to get it open all the way down to the surface. So that's exactly what our challenges are for, is to promote the technology development. And as I said, the ultimate goal is to get habitats on the moon, but you got to get rovers on the moon first. And that all builds to that. And my job is, how can I get more people from all over planet Earth working on this problem right now? So we're going to be posing problems that can be solved in a 2-day weekend, problems that can be solved as an annual competition, problems that can be solved, hopefully we'll raise $1 million for the prize, in 3 to 5 years somebody will win the prize. So we're working on all those different levels of putting ideas out there for people to work on, and absolutely it's about pushing that technology so that routine access to the moon is indeed routine.
What did you call the navigation challenge again?
It's the Aldrin Bell Bruno Lunar Navigation Challenge.
Bell Bruno?
Bell Bruno, yeah. Ed Bell Bruno. Ed Bell Bruno is an interesting guy because he's also an artist, but he'll be part of the art competition as
well. They just recently did a documentary on him because he talked about how his painting and his mathematics go hand in hand, and that he discovered certain mathematical patterns by thinking about them through his painting. So Belbruno is the one who invented these low energy transfers. Buzz Aldrin, but what he created was these Aldrin cyclers. Probably Pamela Clark will be the initial person organizing the mission management, because the gravity gets really subtle in and around the moon. The moon is a very lumpy place. So if you're in lunar orbit, it's not like the idea that an orbit is an ellipse. That's true if you're billiard balls. Really, it's only true if you're infinitely small billiard balls. But that's the Newtonian solution 300 years ago. You take two-point masses, then you get a perfect ellipse. Well, nothing's a point mass, nothing's perfect, and the moon, in fact, is very, very lumpy. So learning how to navigate in and around the moon is not a subtle problem. You don't do it with gluing together some ellipses. They got away with it with Apollo because it was a very, what they figured it out, it was a pretty simple program, but they were actively flying those things all the way around because it's not that simple. And so if we're going to be living in and around the moon, and LunarLM 1 is a really great place for observatories and other kinds of science experiments. We need to go improve the mathematics. We certainly have to improve the software. There aren't anything. You can't calculate one of these orbits. There's about three or four teams. JPL knows how to calculate these minimum energy transfers. Goddard has a team that's getting good at it. Germany has a team that's pretty good at it. And maybe there's one or two more. But we want it to be, 100 people, and we want it to be somebody who can download the app and you can start doing lunar trajectories. That's what this challenge is going to be about. And that's what we're looking for, is there's pieces of this puzzle that can really be accelerated. Looking at the experience of the Google Lunar XPRIZE, what worked and what didn't work with the way they're approaching it. And the main thing that worked with Google is they got hundreds of people working on lunar landers and rovers, when before they did that, there was nobody, not even in governments. NASA wasn't working on a lunar rover. And now there's 20 teams that are building lunar rovers. 10, 20 people in each team. So now you've got hundreds of people looking at lunar technology when before they put up that prize, essentially, there were tens of people, and that was it. Now we want to democratize space and bring more of the law to space technology.
Go over to lunar art. So, do people paint? Do they draw pictures? What is their art?
Lunar artwork. We're announcing these things now. So we're going to run a flash prize in September. We're putting up the platform. So that platform should be up in a couple of weeks, where people can go start registering and submitting their art. But the first one, you'll submit from September 1st to 30th, and it'll be a drawing or a painting, so it'll be a 2D digital art. And then we'll also take poems and short stories. And then we'll pick something and give away. The prizes will be $1,000 for first prize, $500 for second, and $250 for third prize. And then the best part is we're going to try and get that artwork on the moon as well. So we're going to not only give you $1,000, but we're going to get a representation of your art, probably a much smaller version of it, but we want to get it on the moon on the astronautic lander. So not only that's the real prize, is trying to get your poem to be on the moon. So we have ways of doing that. And then that's just the quick start. So we're going to get some nice writing about these themes. We're going to get some nice artwork. So we'll have lots of T-shirts people can now go out and buy and wear and play with. Begin building up that art community. And then we'll be running an annual competition after that. And there will be, we'll allow things like videos and, short films, artwork, 3D art, any sort of writing. And then one of the things I really want to include in all of this is folk music, so science fiction or science-oriented music. So I'm not sure we're going to run that as a competition, if we're just going to make sure we've got bands at all of our events. But we'll have I want to support music as well. So as this grows, as we build up the art competition, it'll happen every year, and there will be different categories. Pretty much any kind of art category will ultimately be supported.
So you're covering all bases, so to speak, right?
Yeah, I wanted to grow into that because I think it's really important. I mean, one of the main reasons I'm here, one of the main reasons almost any Planet Fantasy Science is here, is because we read science fiction. We saw 2001 Space Odyssey. And then the other thing about the artwork that I want to, again, like this, I want to talk about what can we do right now? Because now we know that the lunar frontier starts this decade. It starts now and in the next 10 years. And, you know, some will probably be 20 years. 15 years, 20 years from now, the first humans will be back. The Chinese are going to put a human on the moon in 10 years, almost certainly. But that'll be a lot like Apollo. There'll be a couple of people. If you're not Chinese, you're not going to be able to play. And so while I applaud that, they're convincing the rest of us that it can be done, it should be done, and what are we waiting for? What I'm interested in is these open, broad-based technology entrepreneurial approaches. And another feature of the art, why it's so important to me, is this, you know, this phrase, is the problem must be imagined before it can be solved. And what I want to do is get the artists out there, the science fiction fans, lots of scientists also like science fiction and the like, get those people thinking that if it really is happening now, what's it going to look like? Let's go back and revisit all that golden age science fiction about colonizing the moon and go rewrite it, go reimagine it, go re-envision it. We know now that we're looking for life. We know we're looking for life on Mars. We know we're looking for life on Titan. We know we can mine the moon. These things are no longer science fiction. So now let's go imagine the reality, and the artists are the people who can see farther than the rest of us. Us poor scientists have to only deal with things that work. But in science fiction, you can imagine many things that people would never believe work until you say, oh, I see how that might be done. And so art leads science always. So we're pulling together the sponsors and the programs and the teams to make sure that's an integral part of the lunar initiatives, because we're wanting to bring initiative and momentum and acceleration to lunar planetary exploration.
You have a caller on hold. Are you ready for this?
Thank you.
Hi, caller. Who are you? Where are you? Welcome to the show.
This is Tim Weaver.
Hi, Tim.
I heard you talking about life, about finding life on other planets, and how and the chances of there being life because of the how numerous planets are around stars.
Yes.
I just emailed Dr. Livingston an article on I. Okay, I'm tripping over my own tongue. I emailed him an article about gamma ray bursts. And it's been an emerging science, at least for people who's interested in astrobiology. Because these gamma ray bursts, they tend to, cause apocalyptic events, extinction level events, I believe. They believe it caused one about 450 million years ago. It was like, shortly after, relatively speaking, shortly after the Cambrian explosion. These were actually more frequent back in the early days of the universe, and the scientists concluded that complex life would only have about a 50% chance of not being irradiated by a gamma ray burst starting about 5 billion years ago. So from 13.8 billion years ago to 5 billion years ago, the universe would frequently irradiate planets, and if there was any complex life there, it'd get knocked right back down.
Yep. That's the really amazing thing about life in the universe, is that's really interesting, because, yeah, they decided that there are enough gamma ray bursts that it would have been very hard for life to really get started until just about now. There's been life on Earth for 4.6 billion years or so, and there couldn't may not have been able to be a lot of complex life any earlier than that. That said, that's the stunning thing about life. Life on Earth began at the earliest possible moment. You know, no sooner did the water cool down enough to pool than life shows up. And so it would be quite an interesting thing if life in the universe, we really are part of the first wave, and that, you know, nothing could really have gotten started in a big way until the last 5 billion years or so. But, you know, we got started 4.5 billion years ago. If somebody else got started 5 billion years ago, that extra 500 million years could make a very interesting difference in where they got to compared to where we've gotten to so far. So it's very credible now to be looking for life throughout the universe. And it's also a problem where whether you get a positive answer or a negative answer, it's going to change everything. So if we go to every habitable terrain we can find in our solar system, and there's no life there, yet there's life in every habitable terrain on Earth, that will be very surprising. Far more likely, in my opinion, is that just like on Earth, almost all habitable terrains will have life in them. And then that's the question is, you know, we started 4 billion years ago. Could something have started 2 billion years ago? Why, you know, when does life start? And can it start at any time? Or does it have to start at the very beginning for some strange reason? So, yeah, that's thank you for that. That's really interesting. And that's another example of the universe is stranger and more interesting than we ever imagined. And there's so much to learn and so many exciting things to come about. It's going to be a lot of fun. The next few decades are just going to blow our minds in what we find and what we can do.
Tim, anything more?
Yeah, one more thing. I listened a while back, listened to a talk by John Lewis. He's a big advocate for asteroid mining. He written Mining in the Sky. Basically, he described the moon as it's slag. He essentially said not only there's very little volatiles there, but whatever minerals there, it's mostly going to be trapped in siliconate.
Right.
Right. So, what do you think?
Okay, go. So asteroids have some advantages. The moon has two key advantages. One, if you drop your screwdriver, it's going to fall to your feet and you can pick it up again. So actually working in zero gravity is really hard. So having a little bit of gravity around is a useful thing. The other thing that the moon has, which is why we're going to start there, whether we're talking about habitation or mining, there's one key feature the moon has, and it will always have compared to any other destination in the solar system, and that's an abort option. If you get in a rocket and you start heading to Mars, as soon as you light those rockets off, you're not coming back in less than 2 years. In the moon, you're always a few days away from getting back to Earth. So, especially if we have humans, we'll almost certainly build in abort options where something goes wrong, you can get back to the surface of Earth in 2, 3, 4 days. And so between those two things, there are very good reasons to learn how to become a space-faring species on the moon. The other destinations are absolutely valuable. Asteroid mining is a good thing, and there's plenty of things that you can do on an asteroid that you couldn't do on the moon. But my expectation is that's what I said. The moon is the proving ground. The moon is the training facility. It's where you practice, because you can get there and you can get back on a regular basis. And being able to do that, they call it op tempo, your operations tempo. The ability to fly over and over again quickly is really important. And the moon is the only space destination, you know, other than like low Earth orbit, but the fifth lunar space is the only place where you could be flying every year or two, every month or two, learn something new. And they did that on the Apollo mission. People aren't so aware, even the lunar scientists. There's the five lander mission. They took the lessons learned from the last mission and plowed them into the next one. And you know, they were flying like twice a year during the top piece of that cape. They were flying a lot in Apollo. And one of the key things they did is they took everything they learned from this mission and applied it to the next mission and the mission after that. And then they went out looking for things they don't know yet. And so being able to have that fast turnaround time to fail forward, to learn fast, and to put those that learning into the next mission. There's one of the CubeSat companies is called Planet Labs, and they want to put up a swarm of 200 or so CubeSats to do imaging of the Earth. So they want to take a picture of every location on the Earth once a day. And they're building their CubeSats and pushing their CubeSat technology so fast that they've got something that's still on the shelf after 6 months, they throw it away because it's so decrepit compared to the current version. I want to bring that energy to planetary science. I want people trying to build stuff and fly stuff so fast that if you get a year behind, you just start over with the next one because it's not likely, you get more done with the next version. And so there is a place for that, and Silicon Valley has that type of energy. There's a place for being slow and stately and be careful as well. But I want to bring in this energy of let's try a lot of different things. Let's learn everything we can as fast as we can with what's right in front of us. And we'll get to the asteroid. That's one of the coolest things. Like I said, there's a bunch of asteroids that are actually coming to us. So before you ever spend $1 billion going to mine an asteroid, you're going to want to touch a bunch of them and confirm your theories about what you're going to find when you get there. And so chasing down the little ones that come through the Earth system is a great place to start.
Tim, anything else, or I'll move on? We're almost at the end of the show.
You can move on.
Thank you. Thank you, Tim.
No problem.
Yeah, thank you.
Luis in Venezuela has a question for you. Would it be feasible to have a small constellation of around, say, 4 to 6 CubeSats in lunar polar orbit or another kind of orbit? I don't know what number would be optimum, as data relays to have continuous communication with certain places in the moon, say the site of a lunar rover on a lunar outpost or base.
Great, thank you for that. Another perfect question, because the other challenge, one of the other challenges we'll probably be announcing in October, but we're working on actively, is what we call the deep space internet. And that's another example. The space agencies, the way people build space, because the way people build spacecraft now is you have one big dish on the Earth and you have a radio on the spacecraft and you lock them up and they talk to each other and they're done. Well, that's basically how communications was done in the 60s with telephones. Well, since then, communications technology has moved forward, but space technology hasn't significantly, certainly not in the way they do it. So we're going to create a series of challenges that bring the Internet of Things, bring the Internet protocols into the space program, into CubeSat. And absolutely, it would not take many. 4 is a good number. Putting in just a couple of little data relays in and around the moon. So one of the things I want to encourage through our workshop and the like is right now, all of the different vehicles at Mars have a common radio set so that they can, any rover that's there now can beam up and store data on one of the orbiters and have that data downloaded later. So I want to encourage that same kind of commonality and reusability in the people who are going to the moon. So there's Russia planning. Russia has, most people don't know this. Russia is restarting the lunar program. They have 5 different landers that they want to fly over the next 10 years. And one of their second mission is an orbiter. Korea has an orbiter and a lander. And the Korean orbiter has some internet-capable functionality to it. India has an orbiter-lander combination. China is flying every 2 years. ESA is partnering with the Russia program. And so they'll be participating through that. And then there are, like I said, 4 or 5 Google Lunar XPRIZE teams that are almost certainly going to fly in the next 3 to 5 years. So there's, easily that's 10 different lunar lander missions, and lots of them have orbiter components. So if we can get them to work together, either by picking out some CubeSats when they get there before they land, and those become the relays, or some of these orbiters are more long-lived, and the CubeSat carrier itself can live for a long time, 10 years or so. So that's the other thing. They could keep that carrier, carries a bunch of CubeSats to lunar space, and once it's discharged all those, it's still there. And so then it becomes a data relay for, you know, the next 10 years, even though the CubeSats are all burned up in the first year or so. So there's a lot of exciting. Those are the kinds of things we're doing. We're going to create an environment where you can talk to other people interested in doing things like that. And so through the hackathons and the workshops, we have a lot of work to do in building up the online community and the website, so all this stuff is really visible. But that's what we're doing, is we're creating a global community. You're in Venezuela. You should be able to build a CubeSat. You should be able to work in space. I'm going to support that. Chile has a really good CubeSat program. Good thinking. Absolutely, yes, that could work, and things like that are exactly what's going to happen. And in the context of our event, you could play with people who are doing something like that. So follow us on Facebook. So go to the Lunar Workshops or Lunar Challenges or Hack the Moon on Facebook. Go to Lunar Initiatives, and you can find links to all the other different places from there. And we'll be posting more information. We have 3 workshops a year, 2 hackathons a year. It's all under construction, but that's where we're headed.
Do you have a newsletter that people can sign up for and follow?
Yeah, on the Lunar Cubes website, so lunarcubes.com, there is a subscription button on that website. So that's probably right now the best place to go is either Lunar Initiatives, which links you everywhere, but kind of all of the real information is on the Lunar Cubes because that's what we're building for the moment. So you'll be able to find most of the links there, and then we'll be building out the other websites as we go.
Okay.
So if you start in either of those two places, you'll be able to get information.
Okay, and you told me during the break you attend all of these workshops and part of it, so people who attend will have an opportunity to meet
Absolutely.
And network with you as well, correct?
Yeah, so I organize all of the events. I'm at every event. I typically set the themes, and this workshop's going to focus on this, and then we go out and find the speakers. I'm there, and not only am I there, but like I said, you can meet JPL scientists, you can meet Goddard scientists, you can meet Russian scientists, you can meet people from all over the world who are the top lunar and planetary scientists trying to build things. Another hot piece of news is NASA is going back to the moon. They can't quite say it yet, but they have a project called Resource Prospector, which is a lunar lander and rover that they want to go and drill and find water on the surface of the moon at the South Pole. It's not an official budget item yet, so NASA can't say it, but it's pretty inconceivable that 2020 would come around and the only people on the moon are Russia, China, and India, and NASA doesn't have a mission. So this mission is probably going to get picked up and actually put in the budget this October. Either way, they presented at every Lunar Surface Applications workshop, and they'll be and probably this next April they'll get a whole day. So if you want to learn what NASA's doing, and then you want to learn what the entrepreneurs are doing, it's another thing I haven't mentioned is an entrepreneur day at Lunar Cube. So we talk about how do you kickstart money, how do you use the money once you've kickstarted it, how do you create, how do you build a team, how do you get started. So we have entrepreneurial training associated with Lunar Cubes. We had the hackathon, and then we're now having Lunar Surface Application. We'll have, like I said, last year we had 6 different lunar landers represented there, and next year I want to try and make sure I get Russia and India, and Japan is building a lander for NASA. So I want to get the international partners there as well.
Okay. Well, you'll keep us posted on your progress, okay?
Absolutely.
All right, and good talking to you, and best of luck with everything, and we'll look forward to hearing more from you as your events unfold and as more events get planned.
Great. Thank you for that.
Thanks.
And thank you for the opportunity. Thank you for everyone who wrote in.
Absolutely. And listeners, that's it for tonight. So Doug Messier is our Hotel Mars guest on The Bachelor Show tomorrow, talking about the NTSB report in Virgin Galactic. Charles Miller, speaking about returning to the moon, is with us for the lunar initiative that they have come up with NSS, the new architectural plan. He's going to be discussing that in full, and then back again on our Sunday program. So remember our crowdfunding program. You can access it. Go to thespaceshow.com, and you'll see the buttons in the upper right corner and the upper left corner for Indiegogo, as well as for our support website. Check it out, and some of the things, as I said, have already sold out. So if you see some things of interest, we need your support, and go ahead and jump on it. Thank you again, and everybody have a great rest of the week. Russell, thanks for being with us and for the work you're doing. Good night.
Thank you very much.
Good night, everyone, from the Space Show.